Have you noticed that there are a lot more murals in Kansas City than there used to be? Part of the reason for that is a mural painting event that's happening for the third year in a row this weekend. It started with something intended to be a one-time event to celebrate the solar eclipse in 2017. For that cosmic event with its global focal point in St. Joe, Missouri, a couple of Kansas City artists brought an international team of muralists to paint in the unusual light here in town that day. They created 20 murals, which is crazy, but instead of leaving it at that, the artists decided to do it again the next year, just without the eclipse. They added 23 more murals, and now the event that's come to be known as Spraycimo is about to happen again, not just in the Crossroads, but in the West Bottoms and the City Market, too. I'm Gina Kaufman, this is KCUR Central Standard, and now we're going to learn more with Amy and Jason Harrington. Some of you may know Jason as Riff Raff Giraffe. Hi, guys.
How are you doing?
Why are you called Riff Raff Giraffe? I just need to get past this.
It was a name I came to when I was living in Chicago. I had looked up to artists like Kaz and Barry McGee and saw that they had their iconic characters, and I wanted to create something like that for myself. And twice in a week, I had run across images of a giraffe, once while editing videos, and a Nat Geo film had one getting hunted down. It was terrible. And then I was walking home from the L one day, and in the alley I found like a little toy giraffe, and I was like, well, this is kind of...
The giraffe was just following
it. It was there, so I was like, man, I got to figure out something clever to go with it. And then that name was spawned, and it was probably about, at least 15 years ago now or more.
And what does Spraycimo mean?
Spraycimo is kind of that blend of spray painting murals in Kansas City.
It's more of a play
like
off the
KCMO.
A play off the acronym of KCMO.
Gotcha. So, in what world? How would you describe the world in which you are known as Riff Raff Giraffe? Because you were just when you were telling this story, you were referencing a lot of things that I feel like are shared. It's like a shared understood language you share with a community, but like not all of our listeners know about that.
There's like a unwritten set of rules to anyone who does public street art, specifically painting. I would say that's how a lot of us artists refer to ourselves as our street name. You kind of create an alter ego. I think it was born more of the graffiti scene initially.
Mm-hmm.
And then artists have adopted that as mural painting has become the dominant form in that field, but still want to kind of hold on to those roots of where it came out of.
Yeah, and I understand that part of what you're trying to do is see if Kansas City can hold its own or even surpass famous mural parks in places like Miami, Philadelphia, and Brooklyn. Is that right?
I'd say definitely one of our influences is Wynwood in Miami. A lot of my good friends paint out of there, and my good friend Sebastian Coolidge, who's from Kansas City but paints out of St. Petersburg, convinced me to go down there one year. I was so blown away by the amount of artwork that was in the town that I came back here, sat down with Abbott Properties and Matt Abbott, and preached them what I thought was a good vision for where we could go in town. And
what was that vision?
Just with the way the Crossroads was set up and all the buildings and the walls that they had that was blank space, it was going to really fit the same kind of vibe Wynwood had. So Matt was actually on a plane the next day to Miami, drove immediately to Wynwood, texts me and goes, let's do it. Gave me some seed funding, and that's kind of where it all started.
So explain the significance of those other cities and their mural culture for people who don't know about this stuff, who aren't in on this scene. Amy?
I'm probably not the best person to speak about that. I'm not as educated on the deep roots of that culture, but...
I would say, you know, everything kind of spawned in New York. There was a guy called Cornbread who used to write his name on the subways, and it kind of spilled out from there. So I know Philadelphia has a major scene, and me personally, I haven't spent a lot of time in the Northeast. And then Miami, I know, kind of really kicked it off with Wynwood, and it being like a desolate, rundown place. They started bringing in their friends, and I feel it really started the mural festival movement. If anyone knows, like, the first week of December is Art Basel in Miami, and it's also Design Week, and then Wynwood happens with the mural painting. So it's this epicenter of art in the world at that point in time. And if you really want to see the best artist and you have the time and means, you should really get down to Miami because it's a really beautiful, interesting thing that happens down there.
So what do you think that this type of art adds to the experience of an urban space, whether you're someone who's into art or not, just anyone walking down the street?
Growing up, attending art school and seeing stuff like that, I feel the movement of art in general is to be more interactive. So as the gallery scene kind of, especially museums, where you have museum guards looking over your shoulder, you know, kind of studying your moves, you can't really bring your dog or, you know, you're worried about bumping into stuff. With murals, you can kind of roll around. We have social media now. People like taking pictures with the walls. You know, we're getting to a point where we have augmented reality with the Mural Festival this year, so it's more interactive. I think people are trying to get to that place where they can at least feel like they're part of it. And I think with it being in public space and you being subjected to it more on a consistent basis, hopefully...
Subjected.
Yeah. hopefully it opens up people's eyes and, like, they see that they want this color in spots. And as we go around and notice it here, like, even on our drive to the station... Like, I saw one wall that was really colorful. I was like, see, it's just like, that's the stuff that sticks out. Do you want to see, like, a gray wall with, like, some buff marks on it? Or would you rather see a piece of artwork?
I feel like just in Kansas City, the visual culture of the city itself has changed. The visual stimulation you get from your just city surroundings has become more textured in the last 10 years or so. About 10 years ago, I was in Seattle where... I noticed that just everywhere there was attention to this idea that there's a visual aspect to moving through the city, pops of color, like you were saying. What does that add something to your experience here in Kansas City, Amy?
Yeah, for sure. I've been in the Crossroads for nearly a decade now, not necessarily living here, but having a space in it. And they become landmarks and you start directing people around that and it just becomes part of your everyday life. And it's really nice to have that as, like, benchmarks in your mind, I guess.
There really are a lot of murals here in town. Is there such a thing as being at capacity? Or no, just until every facade is covered, is there room for more?
In my personal belief, that's the way it should go. You're never going to paint every building. Everyone has different ideas of how they'd like the city to look and feel. And you're going to run into a lot of people that own a lot of property that don't want to see it.
Why?
You'd have to ask them. I personally don't have an answer for that.
Well, but some of these murals, I think there are different kind. I mean, obviously there are different kinds of murals, but some of them feel like art for art's sake. And some of them feel more like bumper stickers of Kansas City Pride, which, no disrespect, I love Kansas City Pride, but they have a very different feel, these two kinds of visions, I think.
Usually with the ones that show the Kansas City Pride and whatnot, I mean, I'm a full-time artist and I get commissioned to do a lot of murals and I don't always have what I want to paint for them. And usually the first thing people ask for is the default answer is Kansas City. Like, I want the skyline, I want the river, I want the Kauffman Center, I want Bartle Hall. You know, as much as I can, I try to steer people away from it because I like art for art's sake. You know, people don't realize everyone's trying to create that icon. So people think Kansas City is the icon, but they don't realize if you make great art, that great art becomes the icon.
Yeah, you can step outside and see the city around you. You don't have to have it repainted on a wall in front of you as well.
Yeah, so why not have a new creative image that defines the area rather than relying on the same old things to get you through?
So who's coming to town this year?
Too many people to count.
Statistically, we have 49 individuals, 44 teams. I believe it's something like 17 brand new people that have not painted in Kansas City yet, 16 returning artists, and then I think 11 locals. We have a total of like 4 married couple painters, which is kind of interesting.
And I think we're repping 4 different countries outside the United States as part of our team.
Hey, how did you find these artists? How did you decide who you wanted to come and leave their mark, quite literally, on Kansas City?
We really let it happen organically. Life has blessed us to be able to travel and paint a lot. And in our journeys, we run into these people. And, you know, as cheesy as it sounds, I'm like, it's a vibe thing. You see, if you vibe with the people, it's a group we've already kind of built. So can they fit into this kind of... You know, no one's really demanding, no one's too crazy or off the top, everyone just kind of chill and understands how we do things, and I think that's a very Kansas City vibe.
Okay, so tell me about someone who you are really excited to see what they do, Amy.
Ooh, my gosh, I don't know. There's so many good ones.
Yeah, just whoever pops into your head first.
I think they all pop in. I think I'm most excited to have so many more ladies join us. We have like 10 females coming in this year, which is really nice. But they're going to bring a nice different touch to something that's a little bit more male-dominated currently.
You find it that it's that way in Kansas City now? I know it has been in the past. I wasn't sure if that was still true.
I think so. I mean, it's
the field
always
in general
changing.
Is a male-dominated field, but I feel recently it's really kind of changed
surge.
More. There's definitely been a surge in female mural painters, which I like to say. I like to see everything equal and like even playing ground. So that was definitely a focus of bringing more female painters in this year to add to a little bit more diversity of what we had.
Two people I know that we're super excited to have is Arsic and Erase from Bulgaria and D-Side from New Zealand. They're people that we've been talking to for at least two, three years mm-hmm. now.
Can you describe their work?
I'll let Jason take that one.
I would say D-Side New Zealand focus a lot on environmentalism. I think being from an island country, a lot of it talks to the rising oceans and the society in general. I like that. I like social commentary work, and it's tough to pull off because it can rub a lot of people the wrong way. So it's got to be playful in a way and then also address the point. And then with the Arsic Erase, they're like superstars of the painting world. This is their third time, I think, ever in the United States. So they're looking forward to coming in. We're lucky to have our sponsor, American Shaman CBD, really fund us to be able to bring these kind of artists in because, I mean, bringing two people in from Bulgaria is no cheap thing to do.
How can people, like, check it out? How do people get involved with what's going on while it's happening?
Well, everything's under spraysimo.com. I would say the website probably has the most information on it. We're also on Facebook and Instagram under the same name. We have a list of events Sunday through Saturday, the 8th through the 14th, for the public to enjoy.
Well, Amy and Jason Harrington, thank you so much for being here today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Up next, a Kansas City native who sings opera in Los Angeles and New York and places like that is headed home for his first performance in Kansas City. And his mom is going to be on stage with him because she is an opera singer, too. That story is coming right up on KCUR's Central Standard. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and my next guests are Ben Bliss and Judy Bliss. Ben is a tenor soloist who's in town to play the leading role of Belmonte. Did I say that right?
You did.
In Mozart's Abduction, with the Lyric Opera. Judy is his mom, and she will be singing in the chorus in that same production. She's been singing with the Lyric Opera on and off since 1976, and this is the mother-son duo's first ever time on stage in an opera together. Judy, good morning.
Good morning.
And Ben, hello. Welcome back to Kansas City.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So Ben, start off by telling us about the abduction and your role in it.
Right. So the full title in English, anyway, is The Abduction from the Seraglio, or for you Germanophiles out there, Die Entführung aus dem Seraglio. And it's basically the story of a nobleman whose girlfriend, sidekick, and sidekick's girlfriend are kidnapped by pirates and sold into a Turkish seraglio. Now, that's the original version. Our version takes place in the 1930s Hollywood.
What is a seraglio?
It's like a harem, basically. Okay. So it's, you know, some rich guy in Turkey and his entourage, so to speak. Wink, wink.
Okay. So you're kind of a Mozart specialist at this stage in your career, right?
Yeah, I would say Mozart makes up probably a little over half of the operatic work that I've done, which has been a real treat. It's amazing music, and the operas are often set in a different time and place than they were originally meant to be. So it's always interesting to kind of see the director and the company's take on what they want the piece to be.
You did not get into opera right away, like despite growing up around opera with a mom who sang and continues to sing for the Lyric.
That's right. Yeah. I think I took music for granted a little bit in my childhood. And I went to Shawnee Mission East, and I was really into I really wanted to play football. I love football. Huge Chiefs fan. But it turns out when I was in high school, I was 6'1" and weighed like 120 pounds. So that wasn't meant to be. So I was a theater and choir kid instead. Got really interested in film production, moved out to Southern California to go to college, joined the choir and the music department at my school, Chapman University, twisted my arm into being in the opera and taking voice lessons. And I really got fairly interested in it there, but not enough to sort of change my focus away from film production. I moved up to LA and worked in production on the Dr. Phil show, of all things, for 3 years. And that was... Oh, man, I have so many stories, but
maybe we will have time for some of those.
Maybe. Anyway, after 3 years of that, I was like, you know, opera maybe sounds kind of fun. My voice teacher from college was always saying, you know, everyone always needs tenors and all this. So I give it a shot.
Can I just jump in and say, like, as someone who has listened to opera but never sung it, nor would anyone ever want me to, I am surprised that you don't have to start training your voice really actively and like rigorously from a young age.
Well, in some ways you do. Unlike, say, violinists who have to start practicing when they're 4 years old or whatever, the voice, you know, your voice changes when you're 15, whatever it is, and continues to mature and develop. And I compare it a lot more to kind of like being an athlete, you know, whereas, or a ballet dancer, say, when your peak is like when you're 18, or an athlete and you peak in your mid-20s. As an opera singer, your voice, depending on the type of opera that ends up really being suiting you, like for me, Mozart, your peak ends up being... you know, maybe from your early 30s into your mid 40s or whatever. And so that said, I was singing pretty much my whole life in choirs and this and that. And then when I went to college, I was taking voice lessons and everything. So I didn't just, you know, come out.
You didn't just waltz into someone's room being like, I think I'll be an opera singer.
Right. I didn't start at 25. That's just when I started to really pursue a career in opera.
Judy, did you have a hunch before Ben did that maybe he would end up doing this?
At one point, I thought that he possibly might be an opera singer, but his main focus was really being in the film business. So I knew he had the talent, a lot of raw, you know, not raw talent, but natural talent. So I had an inkling and I was sort of hopeful, but really we wanted our kids to just do what they wanted to do. So we didn't strong arm him into anything.
Tell me about your history with opera.
Well, I was in the early 76-77 was the first season I was in at the Lyric. And then I took a long break, got married, worked,
had a
family.
You didn't just stop with your first stage performance with an opera company. Like, how did you get interested in opera?
Well, I come from a pretty musical family. My sister, my older sister, had been a vocal performance major. My mother was a singer. There are lots of musicians on both sides of the family of my parents. And so I was exposed to a lot of music growing up, for sure. So,
and you just translated that at some point into your own career?
Yes, yes. It just seemed like a natural, it was what I wanted to do, was be involved in music. And so... I feel fortunate that I've been able to do it for all these years.
Are you able to describe what it is that you love about opera in specific?
It is really sort of the culmination of all art forms. I mean, not all art forms, but just it's the singing, the acting, the movement, the language. It sort of encompasses everything.
Wagner called opera Gesamtkunstwerk, which means the complete artwork, in that there's dancing and acting and music and sets and art and the whole thing, which I've always been attracted to as well.
Like yes. Immersive experience.
Absolutely.
So you mentioned your debut with the Lyric was in the 76-77 season. Do I understand right that you took a long break and then started back up in 1991?
Yes, 1991. And I waited till Ben, our youngest, was in first grade and then decided, well, I thought this would be a really good time to start back. And it really was. The kids were in school and my husband was worked at home, so we could kind of juggle things and help cover all the bases.
So, Ben, for you, when you're six, your mom goes back to work in opera. How did you experience that? I mean, not just at six, but at six and beyond, the presence of opera in your life, in your family life.
Right. Well, I do remember being a little kid and having friends come over to play in the sandbox or whatever, and they were just like, man, people are always singing at your house. What's with that? You know, so there was just music around. And I sort of compare it to, you know, if you growing up, if your mom speaks French, it turns out, you know, you grow up and you're like, oh, yeah, I speak a little bit of French. You just kind of absorb it by osmosis. And so there was a lot of that. But I don't really remember specifically when mom went back to work at the opera. But I do remember going to see her in some shows, which was really fun. I will say at that age, I was pretty uninterested in it, though. And I think that that had something to do with the fact that I always joke that, you know, we were able to get our complimentary tickets for my dad and sister and I to go to the opera on Sunday afternoons, which was always in the middle of a Chiefs game. And as previously discussed, that was a tremendous conflict of interest for me. So it was like, well, if I have to choose at like the age of 10 between opera and football, it's like,
I want to ask you about this, because what do you think about like the messages culturally that existed outside your house about these two things, opera and football? Those messages are pretty different.
Well, yeah, totally. And that said, I don't think that I was deeply concerned with or like pulled into, you know, say if we were seeing Cosi or Carmen or something, of like, oh my gosh, this toreador is really going through so much and Carmen is really such a conniving evil. I was just like, oh, this sounds cool. Like, how long till we get to, maybe we'll make it home for halftime.
You know? Judy, is this something that you talked about when your kids were little?
Not particularly. You know, we exposed our kids to a lot of different things. It was important for us for them to be well-rounded. And I think, you know, they were exposed to things, but then they had their choices that they could make.
So then, Ben, talk a little bit more about that journey of coming to opera on your own terms.
Yeah, well, big turning point for me was my sophomore year in college. My freshman year, the guy who was the head of the music school at Chapman said, you will take voice lessons. I was like, okay, fine. And then my sophomore year, my voice teacher said he would like lower my grade if I didn't audition for the opera. And as he always said, which is always the case, they always needed tenors. And so they cast me as the lead role in a Mozart opera, The Magic Flute. And that was my first time being on the other side of it, being on stage. And I really, really enjoyed it. I'd been on stage in plays and musicals and stuff in high school. But this one was different because you're up there trying to tell a story in a different language where your, you know, acting and everything has to be on point. Your diction has to sound like true German. And while you're doing all that, you have to keep things together with 100 people down in the pit. And then, you know, that production has dialogue in it and you have costume changes and then you're singing a duet with the soprano. And it's really kind of like rubbing your belly and tapping your head or vice versa. I can never remember which, but there's a lot to synthesize in real time to try and tell a story, which the challenge of that really, really tickled me. And it turned out to be something that without realizing it, I'd been preparing almost my whole life to do.
I just can't quite imagine being so good at something so obviously that people are like threatening me not to pursue, like threatening me with what they will do if I don't go audition for the opera right this second.
Well, I will say, I think that one of the great things that classical music has working for it, in particular opera, is a really great ground game in terms of recruitment and everything, because even when, you know, I had that experience in college and then after college stepped away from opera and was working in Hollywood and everything, and then coming back to opera, there, you know, if you study opera and it's something you always want to do, it's not really like it is in other fields. where you study opera, you graduate, you get a job in opera, you work for 30 years, and you retire. Everyone has their own path to come to it, and oftentimes there's a big gap between what you learn in school and what it really takes to encompass the full duties of a professional artist, not to mention, as I was saying previously, vocal maturation and experience and everything like that. So there are young artist programs where you can earn a salary to continue learning and study languages and have vocal coachings and understudy roles. And there are competitions where benefactors of opera will, you know, give prizes away, cash prizes, to encourage young people to continue their studies and become opera singers. So that's a really, really big part of it. But it did seem like once I left the Hollywood thing and started jumping into the opera world, it was a lot less of an uphill battle for me. I always felt like opera chose me as much as I chose it. I've been very lucky in that way.
So I want to get back to the opera that you will both be performing in this month. Judy, did you always think, since you found out that Ben would be coming, that you would also like to be on stage for this performance? Or did you consider sitting in the audience to enjoy his first Kansas City show that way?
Absolutely. I considered both options. And I've seen him in this production a number of times. So I thought that...
Including at the Met, right?
Yes, at the Met. And so I thought, I've seen this several times, so I believe I would like to be on stage with him, because I don't know if that will ever happen again.
So have you been rehearsing together already?
We have. This week were our first rehearsals.
What's that been like?
Well, I was telling Ben, it really kind of seemed surreal having him there, because I've been at the Lyric for so long, and then to all of a sudden have him show up at rehearsals. We talked about it, and he said, you know, it's kind of like, I feel like I'm kind of at work with my mom.
Yeah. Because you are.
Yes. Yeah. It's such a trip. I feel like I remember her going to opera rehearsal every night and everything as a kid, and it kind of feels like take your son to work day, you know, but then also...
Except then your son is the soloist.
Well, yeah, but and that's the funny thing, is it's like I've rehearsed with a million different companies in a million different places, but now it's this combination of like, oh, go into the office, but also I feel like my mom is taking me to work. It's really a trip.
So this specific opera and your roles in it, Judy, what is your role? How would you describe it?
I'm in the chorus. In one scene, I'm a harem girl. In another scene...
So you're in your son's harem.
Yeah. Well, yes.
Well, I'm
not
rescuing...
Really
my harem,
oh, right.
He's rescued. She's part of the harem that I'm rescuing my girlfriend from.
Right. Exactly. Yes. And then in another scene, not everything's been staged, but in another scene, I'm a showgirl in the dressing room with the other characters. So.
And then, Ben, you are playing a character named, as you said, Belafonte.
Belmonte.
Belmonte.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No worries.
And talk to me about his character, this character. You sing a lot of Mozart, as we've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that Mozart had to basically tell stories about nobility, even though he wasn't nobility. And I'm curious how that affects your character and his relationships with the other characters around him.
Yeah, well, one of the things that attracts me to Mozart outside of his brilliant music, really, really, so cool, so brilliant, and so many layers and textures and everything. But anyway, one of the things that really interests me in him is something that you can sort of get a sense of in the movie Amadeus, or there are a lot of good, you know, relatively short, consumable Mozart biographies. And he lived in a time where opera was completely supported by, you know, noble benefactors who would commission operas and this and that, and that's fine. But he was not a noble person. He was a quote, commoner. But at the same time, he realized that he was one of the greatest minds in the history of the human race. And although he had his sense of humility, he also hated being talked down to by these people who had not earned their sort of righteous place. And he saw himself as intellectually superior to them in many ways, and for sure in terms of talent and what he was capable of. So there's this great tongue-in-cheek in many of these operas that were commissioned by the nobility where, yes, the opera is about this nobleman and he's doing all the noble things, but oftentimes the far more interesting character in the piece is, for instance, in this piece, my sidekick, Pedrillo, is, he's the one who has all the jokes, and he's the one who's a real, well, you know, Belmonte's a real person too, and I see an interesting character in him, but the commoners are always a lot of fun, and they're very interesting because that's, I think, the role that Mozart saw himself in, and so that theme runs through a lot of his operas. So in this case in particular, it's you know, there's a lot of that going on.
What do you see that's interesting in the role of Belmonte?
Well, there is plenty. He's got a lot going on. He's sort of one of the interesting things about him is that he's kind of out of his depth. You know, he's used to being in his sort of noble world with his, you know, noble family taking care of him, and all of a sudden he's out on his own, and he's on this mission to try and make something happen, and he learns a lot in the process. And then when it comes to the moment of really potentially saving this girlfriend of his, Constanze, which is, you know, the English translation is Constance, and there's a moral tale within that, is that I think in the original setting of the piece, they probably didn't, you know, go out for milkshakes and hold hands and go for cruises. They were probably an arranged couple. And so when he finally rescues her, it's like, oh, wow, do we really know each other? What is this all about? And you've been alone with this Pasha guy for however long it's taken me to rescue you. And there's some interesting questions in there. Outside of all of the tropes I've discussed with Mozart, he had a real innate sense of people and humanity that is one of the things that makes his music so great and so fun to play and sing.
Let's play some music here. You've played Belmonte before, but this is a clip that I grabbed from YouTube that has you singing just an aria from this opera for a small intimate crowd, it looks like, in more of like a concert setting, more than a full-blown opera production. But what's the name of the aria we're about to listen to, and where are we in the plot when you sing it?
This is towards the beginning of the opera. The aria is called O wie ängstlich. And if you had to guess, what do you think ängstlich means? How would you translate that?
Angst. I mean, I just hear
bingo.
Angst.
Bingo. Yeah, it's how angsty. because I'm talking about, I'm really excited to see Constanze, but I'm also kind of nervous. I don't know what to expect. And this is a clip from a concert I sang in a crypt, actually, in the basement of a church.
I was wondering where you were.
Yeah, it's a great location. And my pianist in this piece is a good friend of mine, Lachlan Glenn.
Well, I want to play two little snippets. The first one is very short. It's from the beginning of the aria. I want people to hear this because I want them to hear the like subtlety and restraint at the beginning, which is very much part of opera, but not what people tend to think of. Now let's hear you singing at the end of that same aria when the passion and angstiness has really taken over. This is just a couple minutes later. What do you hear in that? I'm curious what you hear in that aria.
Well, in the aria is a whole other, that's a whole other story. I am one of those singers who hates listening to himself. So I hear that.
We don't hate listening to you, but
well,
go on.
Thanks. Well, you know, there's Mozart's arias often follow sort of like, they call it a da capo form, which means from the start. So you kind of sing through the text and then it starts over and you sing it again, and that is there's something interesting to find in that, because the second time through often it's like, okay, well, what did I mean by that? What am I, you know, what have I learned and what am I deciding? And so at the end I feel like he sort of switches out of the, oh, I'm angsty, I'm excited, what's going to happen? And he's like, all right, I'm doing this. This is going to be great.
So, Judy, when you think about this performance coming up, what are you excited about that you would be excited about even if this wasn't your son's homecoming performance?
We have a lot. We don't have a lot of music in this opera. The chorus doesn't to sing, but we have a lot of stage presence in that we're in a lot of different scenes. So
milling about and stuff.
I'm sorry.
Milling about and stuff.
Well, yes, we're pretty busy actually. We aren't milling about too
much.
No, not in this
milling.
One.
Okay.
It's pretty action packed. But Ben and I, so far, we've been in a couple of scenes together. You know, just having him in the opera has made me look forward to this so much. I've been looking forward to it for quite a while.
What's it like to be back in Kansas City as an adult with a job that brought you here, just as it brings you to other cities around the globe?
Yeah, it's great. You know, I haven't lived in Kansas City full time for like 15 years since I graduated high school. And so, boy, the city's changed so much and totally for the better. It seems like so many interesting new restaurants and artistic things going on and coffee shops and new buildings and everything. It's great to explore. And it's also, you get a really interesting view of a city if you travel there for a weekend for work or whatever. But most cities I go to, I spend anywhere from 4 to 8 weeks there. And it's interesting to do that here in Kansas City and be like, okay, here's what it's like to be in Kansas City for a work trip and staying on the plaza and sort of that flyover view. It's great. It's also really fun because every time I've seen my parents for the last 15 years, either they come to California or Seattle where I live now and stay with me, or I come to Kansas City and stay with them. And it's really weirdly makes me feel even more at home to say, oh yeah, well, let's go have dinner and then you go back to your house and I'll go back to my place. It's
because you
cool.
get to be the adult you in the same city with your parents being who they would be when you aren't in their house anymore.
Yeah, it's really nice.
Has that been that way for you too, Judy?
Yes. It's just so nice to know that he's close by and we can get together when we have some free time and we get to see each other at opera rehearsal.
Judy Bliss, Ben Bliss, thank you both so much.
Our pleasure.
Yes, thank you.
Ben and Judy Bliss are both performing with the Lyric Opera in Mozart's Abduction at the end of this month. Those performances will be at the Kauffman Center starting September 21st. Up next, Meatballs in Space on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kauffman. Don't go away. Who out there has wondered what it would take to put a meatball in space? Probably no one, but our next guest has. He is hoping to launch that first meatball into space from Cupini's in Kansas City tomorrow with live musical performances created specifically for the occasion. I'm Gina Kauffman, and before we head out for the week, let's welcome Matthew Mullinger to KCUR's Central Standard. He's the manager of Cupini's, and this is his vision. Hi, Matthew.
Hey, good morning.
So you've named the meatball.
Yes. Well, his name is Captain Cosmo. It's fitting because he is a cosmonaut, and he's been working out. I think he's ready to go. Right now he's doing a little bit of mental preparation. I think he feels pretty confident, though.
What made you want to send a meatball into space?
Well, you know, there's a couple of things that we were working on here. Over at Cupini's, we work on a new initiative called Cupini's Without Boundaries. So, you know, between our cooking classes, our travel programs, we also, you know, just wanted to show, hey, we'll take it anywhere. We'll even put a meatball in space if that's necessary.
Okay, so how are you going to put a meatball in space?
Well, we think that, you know, after looking at rockets, and NASA just would not loan us anything for this project. We had to go the weather balloon direction. It's a little more budget friendly. So he's going to be, you know, lifted up on a weather balloon that's a little less pressure on his chest. He's only going to be going up about 1,000 feet per minute. You know, so I think he can handle that a little better.
How will this all be staged? Like, if people are going to come to watch the launch of a meatball into space, what is it that they will actually be seeing?
Well, so the launch pad is on our roof, and that's where we will be launching Cosmos shuttle from. So we do have a very large parking lot where people will, you know, be down there relaxing, listening to wonderful music. And then we will get Mr. Cosmo up into space. We'll do a little launch. Should be a beautiful thing.
It sounds beautiful. Yeah. Why a meatball, though? Clearly you're going to be working from among the things at Cupini's. But still, you chose a meatball.
Well, you know, meatballs are one of our, you know, favorite items to eat there. It's one of Franco's favorite recipes. We're really proud of our meatballs. So we thought that would...
as a representative of life on Earth.
Yeah. We thought that would do the trick. And, you know, I think this is also good for national security. We get that meatball out there. He can work with the aliens. And, you know, Cosmo's done a lot of good things for us. He's taking postcards up there, little messages to Martians, you know, that children have written on. So, yeah, I think it'll be a good thing.
You're playing this pretty straight.
What do you mean?
This whole meatball in space thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, we're trying.
So when you planned all of this and you got bands involved, how did people in local bands respond when you approached them about like playing this historic moment where a meatball is launched into space from Westport?
Well, the response has been great, actually. Dimension Bill, which one of the main artists there, Matthew Wyman, wrote the song for the world's longest noodle when we accomplished that. So I approached him and his wife with their new band that they have, and they've been really helpful. We wrote this great, encouraging song for Cosmo, Meatball into Space. That's been good, and, you know, suit just followed after that. We have a nice local artist just built a Cosmo meatball puppet, you know, over at Custom Paper Arts, which is very cool. We're excited to see this puppet.
Why do you need the puppet when the real meatball will be there?
Well, you know, Cosmo won't be there to sign autographs, so somebody has to represent for him. Even though, you know, we will be watching him live as he goes up. We've got all of our cameras ready. You know, so yes, I think somebody will need to represent for him.
So a space launch does require some, like, math, some calculations, some science, some engineering.
That's true.
With NASA having refused or just to get involved or just failed to respond to inquiries about this launch of a meatball into space from an Italian restaurant. Can you tell me how you've worked around that problem of not having
these? Well, there actually were some technical difficulties that we've had to get around, especially, well, you know, with our camera situations as we are filming this live. As, you know, he goes up, we have to, you know, our cameras, antennas, transmitters all have to be on the correct frequency, which is, you know, was a challenge in the first place, and doing that on our own, going, you know, 80,000 feet up.
How did you do it on your own?
Well, we had some help, and what we did is, initially we were trying to find different groups that could assist us, or somebody that's really done this and streamed it live on their own. And the only person we could find was out of the UK in London. And
someone who has done this being launched?
Launching
food?
And launching weather balloon and streaming it live.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
And so, but anyways, those were computer systems that we really didn't want to work with. So we just built our own systems, found it. We have worked with the FAA to ensure that we do what's called a notice to airmen so that they understand that Cosmo is going up. You're welcome to wave at him when he flies by, but just know that That's in the air for you.
And so you really did go through the FAA?
Yeah. Yeah. That is important.
How did you do that?
Well, you call the FAA and you do what's called a notice to airmen to ensure that, you know, just it's important for people to know it's in the air with all those planes just for safety. It's a good thing. And
how did they respond to the news that there would be a meatball launch?
They're excited, you know, received the news well, very supportive, very easy to work with. We were a little close to the airport, the Mr. Wheeler's airport, Charlie Wheeler. But fortunately, we are a quarter of a mile away and safe enough that this will be okay.
So you have three bands performing at this launch event.
We do.
Talk to me about approaching them and what they've got in store and all of that.
Well, we do have three solid bands. Plus Dimension Bill is doing the Meatball in Space song. Kansas City Bear Fighters, incredible local talent, very engaging with the audience, also family friendly, which is what we're looking for. My Oh My, also another really strong, talented group. And they all really love the idea. Good Time Charlie is also going to be out there singing songs. Very receptive. Been helping us out on social media, getting the idea out there, you know, with other local artists. So it's gone well.
So after you have launched a meatball into space, do you think that, like, you know, one small step for a meatball, but one giant leap for Italian food kind or something?
Well, I think it's it's always prideful for the working people in the space industry to. And encouraging to see that people are trying and getting out there. And, you know, hopefully that when those messages are taken to the Martians, it, you know, it'll also be, you know, just a good gesture for, you know, Italian food and people on planet Earth.
When you think, though, like, about things that need to, like, go in space, there is this, like, historically a space race, as in, like, what country will send a man to the moon first, and then what country will, you know, fill in the blank. All of these different stages of space exploration, being the first, has been a race among nations. Do you see there as being some symbolism to being the first to send a meatball to space?
Well, I think there's a little symbolism there, but I also think really just doing things that are starting to explore space, encouraging youth, children, education, just push harder, push the boundaries, go ahead. If my goofy butt can get a meatball into space, I'm sure these genius children that are coming up in the world can do a lot better than that. So
when you think about the possibility of this maybe will work and maybe won't, what is the measure of it has arrived at what you call space, and how will you know if you've succeeded in your mission?
Well, there's two measures of success that I'm looking for. One, to make sure that our technical aspects are tight and the video goes correct. The second measure is that we
reach... This is very pictures or it didn't happen.
What's that?
This is very pictures or it didn't happen.
Oh, pictures or video, but yes. Yeah. Video or it didn't happen. Want that going live so that, you know, people can enjoy that. But I really want to make sure that we get to a point where we see the curvature of the Earth, which is more around the 70,000 feet. And then I will feel, you know, very good about that and a little relieved. And then when he comes down, we'll find him and we'll have a little party.
What happens if it doesn't make it?
He'll make it.
You're unwilling to prepare for the possibility of anything but success in your mission?
He'll make it.
Cosmo, the meatball.
It is Cosmo, yeah.
Matthew Mullinger, manager of Cupini's, thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
To be there when they launch this meatball into space, just head to Cupini's on Westport Road tomorrow evening. The whole event starts at 5 and lasts until 11. And as we've mentioned, there will be live music from the Bear Fighters, Good Time Charlie, and My Oh My, all Kansas City bands. That's a wrap for today and for the week here on KCUR's Central Standard. You can listen to any of the shows you might have missed at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. If you want some context for all of the change swirling around First Fridays and the Crossroads, which will be different tonight from what people have come to expect, grab this Wednesday's episode and give it a listen. kcur.org/centralstandard, and talk to us on Twitter anytime. We are at KCURCST, and we always love chatting you up. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Ann Kniggendorf, Aviva Okeson-Haberman, and intern Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day to keep us sounding great. And our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman, over and out.